ago. Harvard Business School may produce a lot of CEOs, guys who manage public companies, but the real entrepreneurs all seem to go to Wharton. Saul Steinberg, Leonard Lauder, Ron Perelman. The list goes on and on. Perhaps the most important thing I learned at Wharton was not to be overly impressed by academic credentials. It didn't take me long to realize that there was nothing particularly awesome or exceptional about my classmates, and that I could compete with them just fine. The other important thing I got from Wharton was a Wharton degree. In my opinion, that degree doesn't prove very much, but a lot of people I do business with take it very seriously, and it's considered very prestigious. So, all things considered, I'm glad I went to Wharton. I was also very glad to get finished. I immediately moved back home and went to work full-time with my father. I continued to learn a lot. But it was during this period that I began to think about alternatives. For starters, my father's scene was a little rough for my tastes, and by that I mean physically rough. I remember, for example, going around with the men we called rent collectors. To do this job, you had to be physically imposing, because when it came to collecting rent from people who didn't want to pay, size mattered a lot more than brains. One of the first tricks I learned was that you never stand in front of someone's door when you knock. Instead, you stand by the wall and reach over to knock. The first time a collector explained that to me, I couldn't imagine what he was talking about. "What's the point?" I said. He looked at me like I was crazy. "The point," he said, "is that if you stand to the side, the only thing exposed to danger is your hand." I still wasn't sure what he meant. "In this business," he said, "if you knock on the wrong apartment at the wrong time, you're liable to get shot." My father had never sheltered me, but even so, this was not a world I found very attractive. I just graduated from Wharton, and suddenly, here I was in a scene that was violent at worst and unpleasant at best. For example, there were tenants who'd throw their garbage out the window because it was easier than putting it in the incinerator. At one point, I instituted a program to teach people about using the incinerators. The vast majority of tenants were just fine, but the bad element required attention, and to me it just wasn't worth it. The second thing I didn't find appealing was that the profit margins were so low, you had no choice but to pinch pennies, and there was no room for any luxuries. Design was beside the point, because every building had to be pretty much the same. Four walls, common brick facades, and straight up. You used red brick, not necessarily because you liked it, but because it was a penny a brick cheaper than tan brick. I still remember a time when my father visited the Trump Tower site, midway through construction. Our facade was a glass curtain wall, which is far more expensive than brick. In addition, we were using the most expensive glass you can buy, bronze solar. My father took one look and he said to me, "Why don't you forget about the damn glass? Give them 4 or 5 stories of it and then use common brick for the rest. Nobody is going to look up anyway." It was a classic. Fred Trump standing there on 57th Street and 5th Avenue trying to save a few bucks. I was touched. And of course, I understood where he was coming from, but also exactly why I decided to leave. The real reason I wanted out of my father's business, more importantly than the fact that it was physically rough and financially tough, was that I had loftier dreams and visions, and there was no way to implement them building housing in the outer boroughs. Looking back, I realize now that I got some of my sense of showmanship from my mother. She always had a flair for the dramatic and the grand. She was a very traditional housewife, but she also had a sense of the world beyond her. I still remember my mother, who was Scottish by birth, sitting in front of the television set to watch Queen Elizabeth's coronation and not budging for an entire day. She was just enthralled by the pomp and circumstance, the whole idea of royalty and glamour. I also remember my father that day pacing around impatiently. "For Christ's sake, Mary," he'd say. "Enough is enough. Turn it off. They're all a bunch of con artists." My mother didn't even look up. They were total opposites in that sense. My mother loves splendor and magnificence, while my father, who is very down to earth, gets excited only by competence and efficiency. Chapter 4. The Cincinnati Kid. Prudence Pays. In college, while my friends were reading the comics and the sports pages of newspapers, I was reading the listings of FHA foreclosures. It might seem a bit abnormal to study lists of federally financed housing projects in foreclosure, but that's what I did. And that's how I found out about Swifton Village. It was a job that I bought with my father while I was in college, and it was my first big deal. Swifton Village was a 1,200-unit apartment development in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it was a very troubled place. There were 800 vacant apartments. The developers had gone under, the government had foreclosed, and the whole deal was a disaster. But from our perspective, that was great, because it gave us a terrific opportunity. A lot of times, when you are dealing with a government agency on a foreclosure, they just want to get out of it as quickly as possible. They aren't equipped to manage it. In this case, things had deteriorated so badly that no one else was even bidding. Today, you'll find the same thing if you go out to the Sun Belt, where they built all that housing during the oil boom. Now you have huge developments with 30 and 40% vacancy rates. Developers are suicidal because banks are foreclosing on them. It's a great time for a smart buyer, because you can get unbelievable deals. My father and I put in a very minimal bid for Swifton, and it was accepted. We ended up paying less than $6 million for a job which had cost twice that much to build just 2 years earlier. We were also immediately able to get a mortgage for what we paid, plus about $100,000, which we put toward fixing the place up. In other words, we got the project without putting down any money of our own. All we had to do was go and run it. And if we did even a halfway decent job, we could easily cover our mortgage from the proceeds of the rent. The fact that it was such a big job appealed to my father and to me because it meant we could focus a lot of energy on it without feeling we were wasting our time. It takes almost the same amount of energy to manage 50 units as it does 1,200. Except that with 1,200, you have a much bigger upside. After we negotiated the deal, success became a matter of management and marketing. The challenge was to get the place rented, and rented to good tenants who would stay there. The tenants who were living in the project when I took over had ripped the place apart. Many of them had come down from the hills of Kentucky. They were very poor and had 7 or 8 children, almost no possessions, and no experience living in an apartment complex. They crammed into 1-room and 2-room apartments, and their children went wild. They would just destroy the apartments and wreak havoc on the property. The tenants not only didn't care, many of them also didn't see fit to pay rent. If you pressed them, they had a tendency to take off. What we discovered is that to avoid paying rent, these people would rent a trailer, pull it up in front of their apartments at 1 or 2 in the morning, and disappear into the night with all their belongings. That was fine by me, but I wanted to make sure we got paid first. Our solution was to institute a trailer watch. We had someone on round-the-clock patrol. After we got rid of the bad tenants, we set about fixing the place up to attract a better element. That required a substantial investment, almost $800,000 by the time we were done, which was a lot of money in those days. But it was more than worth it. In New York, the laws prevent you from getting fair increases even when you make improvements. But in Cincinnati, we were immediately able to charge and get much higher rents for the apartments at Swifton Village. The first thing we did was invest in beautiful white shutters for the windows. That may not sound like a big deal, but what the shutters did was give a bunch of cold red brick buildings a feeling of warmth and coziness, which was important. It was also much more expensive than you'd guess, because you're talking about 1,200 units, each of which has 8 to 10 windows. The next thing we did was rip out the cheap, horrible aluminum front doors on the apartments and put up beautiful colonial white doors. I made sure the whole complex was very clean and very well maintained. As I said earlier, I've always had a personal thing about cleanliness. But I also believe it's a very good investment. For example, if you want to sell a car, and you spend $5 to wash and polish it, and then apply a little extra elbow grease, suddenly you find you can charge an extra $400, and get it. I can always tell a loser when I see someone with a car for sale that is filthy dirty. It's so easy to make it look better. It's no different in real estate. Well-maintained real estate is always going to be worth a lot more than poorly maintained real estate. That's been less true during the past few years in New York, when there's been such a fever for real estate that people buy anything. But it's a mistake to be lulled by good times. Markets always change, and as soon as there's a downturn, cleanliness becomes a major value. We painted the hallways, we sanded and stained the floors, we kept the vacant apartments immaculately clean, and we landscaped the grounds. We also ran beautiful newspaper ads for the project, at a time when not many people in Cincinnati were advertising real estate. People came to check us out, and the word of mouth started getting good. Within a year, the buildings were 100% rented. Along the way, we went through a half dozen different project managers before we found the one we wanted. We had managers who were honest, but dumb, including one guy who literally painted himself into the corner of an apartment. Others were smart, but didn't know the first thing about managing. Fortunately, we went through them fast, because I tend to size people up pretty quickly. Ultimately, we got a fabulous man whom I'll call Irving. Irving was 65 years old and a real character. He was one of the greatest bullshit artists I've ever met. But in addition to being a very sharp talker and a very slick salesman, he was also an amazing manager. Irving was the kind of guy who worked perhaps an hour a day and accomplished more in that hour than most managers did in 12 hours. I learned something from that. It's not how many hours you put in, it's what you get done while you're working. The problem with Irving was that he wasn't the most trustworthy guy in the world. I suspected as much from the first day. But it wasn't until I tried to put a bond on him, something I do with any employee who handles money, that my instincts were confirmed. My insurance agent called me back after running a check, and he said, "Donald, you've got to be kidding about a bond. This guy is a con man." It turned out that Irving had done all sorts of con jobs and swindles, and he'd often been in trouble with the law. My philosophy has always been that if you ever catch someone stealing, you have to go after him very hard, even if it costs you 10 times more than he stole. Stealing is the worst. But with Irving, I had a dilemma. He was far and away more capable than any honest manager I had found. And so long as he was in charge, no one under him would dare steal. That meant I only had to keep my eye on him. I used to kid Irving. I'd say, "We pay you $50,000 and all you can steal." And he would act all upset. If I'd caught him in the act, I would have fired Irving on the spot. But I never did. Still, I figure he managed to steal at least another $50,000 a year. Even so, I was probably getting a bargain. One day I walked into the office, and one of the girls who worked there was crying. It turned out that there was something they called a funeral fund, to which they'd all contributed in order to buy flowers for anyone they knew who'd died. They had about $80 in the fund. When I asked the girl what she was crying about, she said, "Oh, that Irving, he stole our funeral fund." I went to Irving and I said, "Irving, damn it, did you steal their money?" Of course, he just denied it. He swore he'd get those girls, and he ranted and raved for half an hour. But I always assumed the girls were telling the truth. Irving was a classic. He had problems, but he was a classic. I'll give you an example of how Irving worked. You've got to understand that we're talking about a short, fat, bald-headed guy with thick glasses and hands like jello, who'd never lifted anything in his life beside a pen, and who had no physical ability whatsoever. What he did have, however, was an incredible mouth. As I mentioned, in the early days we had a good number of tenants who didn't believe in paying rent. Sometimes Irving would go out and collect himself. He'd ring the doorbell, and when someone came to the door, he'd go crazy, He'd get red in the face, use every filthy word he could think of, and make every threat in the book. It was an act, but it was very effective. Usually they paid up right then and there. One day, while Irving was on his rounds, he knocked on a door, and a little 10-year-old girl answered. Irving said, "You go tell your father to pay his effing rent, or I'm going to knock his ass off!" And he went on like that until the girl's mother came out to see what was going on. As it happened, she was an absolutely beautiful woman. Now, Irving had a weakness for all women, and this woman was quite exceptional. So immediately Irving started putting the move on her. He invited her out to dinner. The woman, whose husband was either a truck driver or a construction worker, had never experienced anyone like Irving, and obviously didn't know what to make of him. There was no way, however, that she was interested in Irving. And finally, he gave up, and we left. About an hour later, Irving and I were sitting in his office when this huge guy, a monster, maybe 240 pounds, burst through the door. He was furious that Irving had cursed in front of his daughter, and he was ready to strangle him for coming on to his wife. The guy had murder in his eyes. I expected Irving, if he had any sense, to run for his life. Instead, he started verbally attacking the man, flailing and screaming and chopping his hands in the air. "You get out of this office," he said. "I'll kill you. I'll destroy you. These hands are lethal weapons. They're registered with the police department." I'll never forget how the guy looked at Irving and said, "You come outside, you fat crap. I want to burn grass with you." I always loved that phrase, burn grass. And I thought to myself, Irving is in serious trouble. But Irving didn't seem to think so. "I'd fight you any time you want," he said, "but it's unlawful for me to fight." All you had to do was look at Irving to know those hands were hardly registered weapons. But Irving was very much like a lion tamer. You've seen these guys, maybe 150 pounds, who walk blithely into a cage where there's a magnificent 800-pound lion pacing around. If that animal sensed any weakness or any fear, he'd destroy the trainer in a second. But instead, the trainer cracks his whip, walks with authority, and amazingly, the lion listens. Which is exactly what Irving did with this huge guy. Except his whip was his mouth. The result was that the guy left the office. He was still in a rage, but he left. Irving probably saved his own life just by showing no fear. And that left a very vivid impression on me. You can't be scared. You do your thing, you hold your ground, you stand up tall, and whatever happens, happens. As for Swift and Village, once Irving had it running well, I began spending less and less time there. I wasn't really needed anymore in Cincinnati, so I cut back my visits to Swifton, first to once a week, and eventually to once a month. Early on, I'd become particularly friendly with one of the newer tenants at Swifton. He was Jewish, an older man who'd been in a concentration camp in Poland. He'd started off in America as a butcher, then bought the shop, and by the time I met him, he owned perhaps 14 butcher shops. He and his wife had taken two apartments in Swifton and put them together, and they had a great place, and they were very happy there. I had a lot of respect for this guy, because he had street smarts, he'd been around, and he was obviously a true survivor. One day, a number of years after we first bought the place, I was out visiting. I ran into my friend. "How are you doing? How are you feeling?" I asked. "Good, good," he replied. But then he took me aside and whispered, "Donald, you are a friend of mine, and I have to tell you, sell this job." And I said, "Why?" "Because it's going real bad. Not the job, but the area. It's being surrounded by people who are so bad they will cut your throat and walk away and not even think about it. I'm talking about people who enjoy cutting throats." That was the exact expression. I never forgot it. Now, I'm someone who responds to people I have respect for, and I listen. Again, it's instincts, not marketing studies. So I spent an extra 2 days in Cincinnati, and I rode around, and I saw that there was trouble brewing, that neighborhoods were getting rough. I put the job up for sale, and almost immediately we got an offer. We We'd already done very well with Swift and Village, because our debt was very small relative to the size of the complex, and our rent roll, by the end, had reached about $700,000 a year. But selling was how we made a real killing. The buyer was the Prudent Real Estate Investment Trust. Those were the go-go days when real estate investment trusts, partnerships that invested in real estate, were very hot. The banks were loaning money to any REIT. The only problem was that many of the people running the REITs were neither knowledgeable nor competent. I called them the guys with the white bucks. They were the sort of people who'd throw money into a project in Puerto Rico without even going to see it. Eventually, they discovered that the building they thought they'd bought had never even been built. In the case of Prudent, they sent a young man out to inspect and evaluate the property prior to making a final decision on whether to go forward with the sale. This kid was about my age, but he looked like a teenager. Frankly, I was surprised they'd entrusted such a big decision to him. It turned out that what he wanted to do more than anything was go out for lunch. He'd heard about this restaurant in downtown Cincinnati called the Maisonette, which was supposed to be one of the 5 best restaurants in the country. He really wanted to eat there, and when he called to say he was coming, he asked me to make a lunch reservation. I said fine. His flight came in a little late, about midday, and I met him, and I took him over to Swifton Village and showed him the job. We still had 100% occupancy at the time, and he wasn't interested in asking a lot of questions beyond that. He was anxious to get to the Maisonette. It took about half an hour to get there from Swifton, and we ended up spending about 3 hours over lunch, which is the opposite of the way I normally work. If I'd had only one day to look over a big job like Swifton, I'd sure as hell skip lunch and spend my time learning everything I could about what I was thinking of buying. By the time we were done with lunch, it was almost 4 o'clock, and I had to take him to his plane. He returned to New York well-fed and feeling great, and he strongly recommended going ahead with the purchase. He told his bosses that the area was wonderful and that Swifton was a great deal. They approved the sale. The price was $12 million, or approximately a $6 million profit for us. It was a huge return on a short-term investment. What happened next is that we signed a contract. By then, I could see the dark clouds clearly on the horizon. A lot of tenants had their leases coming up and weren't planning to renew. We put a clause in the contract of sales saying that all representations contained in it were as of the signing of the contract, not as of the closing, which is what's typically required. In other words, we were willing to represent that the project was 100% rented at the time of the contract signing, but we didn't want to make the same promise at the time of closing, 3 or 4 months down the line. The other thing I did was to insist on a clause in the contract in which they guaranteed they'd close, or else pay a huge penalty. That was also very unusual, because in nearly every other deal, the buyer puts up a 10% deposit, and if he fails to close, all he forfeits is the deposit. Frankly, the prudent people should have been more prudent. But as I said, the REITs were hot to trot, and they couldn't make deals fast enough. In the end, of course, it never pays to be in too much of a hurry. On the day we closed, there were dozens of vacant apartments. Chapter 5. The Move to Manhattan. I had my eye on Manhattan from the time I graduated from Wharton in 1968. But at that point, the market in the city was very hot. The prices seemed very high, and I was unable to find a deal I liked, meaning a good piece of property at a price I found affordable. My father had done very well for himself, but he didn't believe in giving his children huge trust funds. When I graduated from college, I had a net worth of perhaps $200,000, and most of it was tied up in buildings in Brooklyn and Queens. So I waited. I went to work helping to run my father's business, and I continued to spend as much time as possible in Manhattan. The turning point came in 1971, when I decided to rent a Manhattan apartment. It was a studio in a building on 3rd Avenue and 75th Street, and it looked out on the water tank in the court of the adjacent building. I jokingly referred to my apartment as a penthouse, because it did happen to be near the top floor of the building. I also tried to divide it up so that it would seem bigger. But no matter what I did, it was still a dark, dingy little apartment. Even so, I loved it. Moving into that apartment was probably more exciting for me than moving, 15 years later, into the top 3 floors of Trump Tower on 5th Avenue and 57th Street overlooking Central Park. You have to understand, I was a kid from Queens who worked in Brooklyn, and suddenly I had an apartment on the Upper East Side. The really important thing was that by virtue of this move, I became much more familiar with Manhattan. I began to walk the streets in a way you never do if you just come in to visit or do business. I got to know all the good properties. I became a city guy instead of a kid from the boroughs. As far as I was concerned, I had the best of all worlds. I was young, and I had a lot of energy, and I was living in Manhattan, even though I commuted back to Brooklyn to work. One of the first things I did was join Le Club, which at the time was the hottest club in the city, and perhaps the most exclusive, like Studio 54 at its height. It was located on East 54th Street, and its membership included some of the most successful men and the most beautiful women in the world. It was the sort of place where you were likely to see a wealthy 75-year-old guy walk in with 3 blondes from Sweden. I'll never forget how I became a member. One day I called up Le Club, and I said, "My name is Donald Trump, and I'd like to join your club." The guy on the other end of the phone just laughed and said, "You've got to be kidding." Nobody, of course, had heard of me. The next day I got another idea, and I called back and I said to the guy, "Listen, could I have a list of your members? I may know someone who is a member." And he said, "I'm sorry, we don't do that." And he hung up. The next day I called again and said, "I need to reach the president of the club. I want to send him something." For some reason, the guy gave me the president's name and his business number, and I called him up. I introduced myself. I said very politely, "My name is Donald Trump, and I'd like to join Le Club." And he said, "Do you have any friends or family in the club?" And I said, "No, I don't know anybody there." He said, "Well, what makes you think you should be admitted as a member?" I just kept talking and talking, and finally this fellow said to me, "I'll tell you what, you sound like a nice young man, and maybe it would be good to have some younger members. So why don't you meet me for a drink at 21? The next night we met for a drink. There was just one small problem. I don't drink, and I'm not very big on sitting around. My host, on the other hand, liked to drink, and he had brought along a friend who also liked to drink. For the next 2 hours we sat there as they drank and I didn't, until finally I said, "Listen, fellas, can I help you get home?" And they said, "No, let's just have one more." Now, I just wasn't used to that. I have a father who has always been a rock, very straight and very solid. My father would come home every night at 7, have his dinner, read the newspaper, watch the news, and that was that. And I'm as much of a rock as my father. This was a totally different world. I remember wondering if every successful person in Manhattan was a big drinker. I figured if that was the case, I was going to have a big advantage. Finally, about 10, these guys had enough, and I practically had to carry them home. 2 weeks passed, and I never heard from the president. Finally, I called him, and he didn't even remember who I was. So now I had to go through the whole thing all over again, back to 21. Only this time he didn't drink as much, and he agreed to put me up for membership. He had only one misgiving. He said that because I was young and good-looking, and because some of the older members of the club were married to beautiful young women, he was worried that I might be tempted to try to steal their wives. He asked me to promise that I wouldn't do that. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. My mother is as much of a rock as my father. She is totally devoted to my father. They recently celebrated 50 years of marriage. That's what I grew up with. And here's this guy talking about stealing wives. Anyway, I promised. I was admitted to the club, and it turned out to be a great move for me, socially and professionally. I met a lot of beautiful young single women, and I went out almost every night. Actually, I never got involved with any of them very seriously. These were beautiful women, but many of them couldn't carry on a normal conversation. Some were vain, some were crazy, some were wild, and many of them were phonies. For example, I quickly found out that I couldn't take these girls back to my apartment, because by their standards, what I had was a disaster, and in their world, appearances were everything. When I finally did get married, I married a very beautiful woman, but a woman who also happens to be a rock, just like my mother and father. During that same period, I also met a lot of very successful, very wealthy men at Le Club. I had a good time when I went out at night, but I was also working. I was learning how the New York scene operates, and I was meeting the sort of people with whom I'd eventually work on deals. I also met the sort of wealthy people, particularly Europeans and South Americans, who eventually bought the most expensive apartments in Trump Tower and Trump Plaza. It was at Le Club that I first met Roy Cohn. I knew him by reputation and was aware of his image as a guy who wasn't afraid to fight. One night I found myself sitting at the table next to him. We got introduced, and we talked for a while, and I challenged him. I like to test people. I said to him, "I don't like lawyers. I think all they do is delay deals instead of making deals, and every answer they give you is no, and they are always looking to settle instead of fight." He said he agreed with me. I like that, and so then I said, "I'm just not built that way. I'd rather fight than fold, because as soon as you fold once, you get the reputation of being a folder." I could see Roy was intrigued, but he wasn't sure what the point of it all was. Finally, he said, "Is this just an academic conversation?" I said, "No, it's not academic at all. It so happens that the government has just filed suit against our company and many others under the Civil Rights Act, saying that we discriminated against blacks in some of our housing developments." I explained to him that I'd spent that afternoon with my father, talking to lawyers in a very prestigious Wall Street firm, and that they'd advised us to settle. That's exactly what most businessmen do when the government charges them with anything, because they just don't want bad publicity, even if they believe they can beat a phony rap. The idea of settling drove me crazy. The fact was that we did rent to blacks in our buildings. We wanted tenants who we could be sure would pay the rent, who would be neat and clean and good neighbors, and who met our requirement of having an income at least 4 times the rent. So I said to Roy, "What do you think I should do?" And he said, "My view is to tell them to go to hell and fight the thing in court and let them prove that you discriminated, which seems to me very difficult to do, in view of the fact that you have black tenants in the building." He also told me, "I don't think you have any obligation to rent to tenants who would be undesirable, white or black, and the government doesn't have a right to run your business." That's when I decided Roy Cohn was the right person to handle the case. I was nobody at the time, but he loved a good fight, and he took on my case. He went to court, and I went with him, and we fought the charges. In the end, the government couldn't prove its case, and we ended up making a minor settlement without admitting any guilt. Instead, we agreed to do some equal opportunity advertising of vacancies for a period of time in the local newspaper. And that was the end of the suit. I learned a lot about Roy during that period. He was a great lawyer, when he wanted to be. He could go into a case without any notes. He had a photographic memory and could argue the facts from his head. When he was prepared, he was brilliant and almost unbeatable. However, he wasn't always prepared. Even then, he was so brilliant that he could sometimes get away with it. Unfortunately, he could also be a disaster. And so I would always question Roy very closely before a court date. If he wasn't prepared, I'd push for a postponement. I don't kid myself about Roy. He was no Boy Scout. He once told me that he'd spent more than 2/3 of his adult life under indictment on one charge or another. That amazed me. I said to him, "Roy, just tell me one thing. Did you really do all that stuff?" He looked at me and smiled. "What the hell do you think?" he said. I never really knew. Whatever else you could say about Roy, he was very tough. Sometimes I think that next to loyalty, toughness was the most important thing in the world to him. For example, All Roy's friends knew he was gay, and if you saw him socially, he was invariably with some very good-looking young man. But Roy never talked about it. He just didn't like the image. He felt that to the average person, being gay was almost synonymous with being a wimp. That was the last thing he wanted to project, so he almost went overboard to avoid it. If the subject of gay rights came up, Roy was always the first one to speak out against them. Tough as he was, Roy always had a lot of friends, and I'm not embarrassed to say I was one. He was a truly loyal guy. It was a matter of honor with him, and because he was also very smart, he was a great guy to have on your side. You could count on him to go to bat for you, even if he privately disagreed with your view. And even if defending you wasn't necessarily the best thing for him, he was never two-faced. Just compare that with all the hundreds of respectable guys who make careers out of boasting about their uncompromising integrity but have absolutely no loyalty. They think only about what's best for them, and don't think twice about stabbing a friend in the back if the friend becomes a problem. What I liked most about Roy Cohn was that he would do just the opposite. Roy was the sort of guy who'd be there at your hospital bed, long after everyone else had bailed out, literally standing by you to the death. In any case, I got to know a lot of people when I moved to Manhattan, and I got to know properties, but I still couldn't find anything to buy at a price I liked. Then suddenly, in 1973, things began to turn bad in Manhattan. I'd always assumed the market would cool off, because everything runs in cycles and real estate is no different. Even so, I never expected things to get as bad as they did. It was a combination of factors. First, the federal government announced a moratorium on housing subsidies, which they had been giving out by the bushel, particularly in the city. At the same time, interest rates began to rise, after being so stable for so many years that it was easy to forget they could move at all. Then, to make things worse, there was a spurt of inflation, particularly in construction costs, which seemed to rise even when there's no inflation anywhere else. But the biggest problem by far was with the city itself. The city's debt was rising to levels that started to make everyone very nervous. For the first time, you heard people talk about the city going bankrupt. Fear led to more fear. Before long, New York was suffering from a crisis of confidence. People simply stopped believing in the city. It wasn't an environment conducive to new real estate development. In the first 9 months of 1973, the city issued permits for about 15,000 new apartments and single-family homes in the five boroughs. In the first 9 months of 1974, the number dropped to 6,000. I worried about the future of New York City, too. But I can't say it kept me up nights. I'm basically an optimist. And frankly, I saw the city's trouble as a great opportunity for me. Because I grew up in Queens, I believed, perhaps to an irrational degree, that Manhattan was always going to be the best place to live, the center of the world. Whatever troubles the city might be having in the short term, there was no doubt in my mind that things had to turn around ultimately. What other city was going to take New York's place? One of the pieces of property that had always fascinated me was the huge abandoned rail yard along the Hudson River, beginning at 59th Street and extending all the way up to 72nd Street. Every time I drove along the West Side Highway, I found myself dreaming about what could be built there. It didn't take a genius to realize that 100 acres of undeveloped riverfront property in Manhattan had a lot of potential. But it was another story to consider trying to develop such a huge piece of property when the city was in the midst of a financial crisis. I don't believe that you can ever be hurt by buying a good location at a low price. At the time, a lot of neighborhoods on the West Side were considered dangerous places to live. There were welfare hotels on every side street, and drug dealers in every park. I remember the New York Times running a long series of articles about the block between Central Park West and Columbus Avenue at 84th Street. What a tough area it was. Even so, you didn't have to look very far to see how easily it could all change. Even on the tough side streets, like West 84th, There were magnificent old brownstones only a few steps away from Central Park. And on the avenues, especially Central Park West and Riverside Drive, there were beautiful old buildings with huge apartments and spectacular views. It was only a matter of time before people discovered the value. One day, in the summer of 1973, I came across a newspaper story about the Penn Central Railroad, which was in the middle of a massive bankruptcy filing. This particular story said that the Penn Central trustees had hired a company headed by a man named Victor Palmieri to sell off the assets of the railroad. Among the assets, it turned out, were those abandoned yards in the West 60s, as well as more yards in the West 30s. The deal Victor made with the Penn Central was that each time his company managed to find a buyer for an asset, he got a percentage of the sale. I had never heard of Victor Palmieri, but I realized immediately that he was someone I wanted to know. I called his representatives and said, "Hello, my name is Donald Trump, and I'd like to buy the 60th Street Yards." The simplest approach is often the most effective. I think they liked my directness and my enthusiasm. I hadn't built anything yet, but what I did have was the willingness to go after things that people in a better position than mine wouldn't have considered seeking. I went to meet Victor, and we got on very well right from the start. He was a very smooth, attractive guy, an Italian, who looked like a wasp. I told him how bad the 60th Street Yards were, that the neighborhood was in trouble and the city was in trouble, and that I was probably crazy to be interested in the property at all. If you want to buy something, it's obviously in your best interest to convince the seller that what he's got isn't worth very much. The second thing I told Victor was how incredibly hard it was going to be, politically, to get zoning approvals for such a big piece of undeveloped land. I pointed out that the community board would fight any development, and that the process of going before the City Planning Commission and the Board of Estimate would be endless. The third thing I did, and probably the most important, was to sell myself to Victor and his people. I couldn't sell him on my experience or my accomplishment, so instead I sold him on my energy and my enthusiasm. Victor banks on people, and he decided to take a shot on me. He ended up suggesting that I develop not only the 60th Street Yards, but also the yards on West 34th Street. In truth, I probably oversold myself to him. I had no other choice. I was 27 years old at the time, and I had never built anything in Manhattan, nor had my father. Much as Victor liked me, I don't think he could have justified going with me if he hadn't believed our company was big and powerful. We had no formal name for the company when I met Victor, so I began to call it the Trump Organization. Somehow the word organization made it sound much bigger. Few people knew that the Trump Organization operated out of a couple of tiny offices on Avenue Z in Brooklyn. The other thing I promoted was our relationship with politicians, such as Abraham Beam, who was elected mayor of New York in November of 1973. My father did belong to the same Democratic club that Abe Beam came out of, and they did know each other. Like all developers, my father and I contributed money to Beam and to other politicians. The simple fact is that contributing money to politicians is very standard and accepted for a New York City developer. We didn't give any more to Beam than a lot of other developers did. In fact, it often seemed to me that, perhaps because we knew Beam personally, he almost went out of his way to avoid any appearance that he was doing us any special favors. Instead, I spent most of the 4 years when Beam was mayor trying to promote the West 34th Street site for a convention center. It was by far the best site on the Merits, and we eventually got nearly every big-name New York City businessman behind us. Still, Beam never came out in support of the site until a few weeks before he left office, nor did he ever give it his official approval. It was Ed Koch, newly elected in 1978, who finally chose our site for the convention center. No one, so far as I know, has ever suggested that Donald Trump and Ed Koch are close personal friends. But that's getting well ahead of the story. By building a close relationship with Victor from the start, I was able, in effect, to work for him, rather than to be just another buyer. That was terrific for me. For example, we drew up agreements giving me an exclusive option to purchase the 60th Street and 30th Street yards, but subject to zoning, subject to approval by the court handling the Penn Central bankruptcy, subject to everything except my having to put up any money. The Penn Central even agreed to pay my development costs. It was remarkable in a way. The seller paying for the cost of the potential buyer. Still, you have to put it into perspective. What sounds like a stupid deal today was very different at a time when no one wanted to build anything, and the city was dying. Palmieri, in turn, helped give me credibility with the press. When he was asked by a reporter from Barron's why he chose Trump over others, he said, "Those properties were nothing but a black hole of undefinable risk." We interviewed all kinds of people who were interested in them, none of whom had what seemed like the kind of drive, backing, and imagination that would be necessary. Until this young guy, Trump, came along. He's almost a throwback to the 19th century as a promoter. He's larger than life. At one point, when I was hyping my plans to the press but in reality getting nowhere, a big New York real estate guy told one of my close friends, "Trump has a great line of shit. But where are the bricks and mortar?" I remember being outraged when I heard that, and I didn't speak to this guy for more than a year. But looking back, I can see he was right. It could all have gone up in smoke. If I hadn't managed to make one of those first projects happen, if I hadn't finally convinced the city to choose my West 34th Street site for its convention center, and then gone on to develop the Grand Hyatt, I'd probably be back in Brooklyn today collecting rents. I had a lot riding on those first projects. On July 29, 1974, we announced that the Trump Organization had secured options to purchase the two waterfront sites from the Penn Central, West 59th Street to West 72nd Street, and West 34th Street to West 39th Street, at a cost of $62 million, with no money down. The story made the front page of the New York Times. My original idea was to build middle-income housing on the sites at rents that seem ridiculously cheap today. $110 to $125 a room, but were considered moderately high at the time. I planned to seek financing from the Mitchell-Lama program, through which the city provided low-interest long-term mortgages and tax abatements to builders. The program had been initiated to encourage middle-income housing. The month before our announcement, Victor and I and some of his people met with Abe Beam to sound him out about our development plans. Although he was encouraging, from the moment we went public, he refused to take any position until our plan had been considered by city agencies, including the City Planning Commission, the Board of Estimate, and the local community boards. He was a politician, and he wanted to see which way the winds were blowing before he took a stand. No sooner had I announced my plans publicly than other bidders for the rail yard suddenly came out of the woodwork. Sterrett Housing, for example, a company we were partners with on the Sterrett City Housing Project in Brooklyn, made a bid of $150 million, contingent on financing and city approvals and all the rest. On the face of it, their bid was a lot higher than mine. I'm the first to admit that I am very competitive, and that I'll do nearly anything within legal bounds to win. Sometimes part of making a deal is denigrating your competition. In this case, I happen to genuinely believe that the Sterrett bid wasn't legitimate, that the company would never close the deal and would not be able to successfully develop the site even if the deal did go through. The fact is that anyone can bid anything, particularly when there are all sorts of contingencies. The same thing could be said about my bid, except that by then I'd put in enough time and effort to have convinced Palmieri's people that I was very serious and very committed. In the end, I managed to convince Palmieri that it made more sense to stick with my $62 million bid than to take a flyer on Sterrett. The irony is that less than a year after I announced my plans for the site and beat my competition, the economic situation in New York City turned from bad to much worse. In February 1975, the Urban Development Corporation, the state agency that sold bonds to finance public housing, defaulted on more than $100 million of repayment on its bonds. In September 1975, Beam announced that because of the fiscal crisis, the city was suspending its own plans to finance the construction of virtually all new housing. In November 1975, the state announced that it, too, was suspending any financing of lower- and middle-income housing for the next 5 years, including a huge number of city projects that had already received preliminary approval. You couldn't get up in the morning without running across some new headline about the city's fiscal crisis. I can't say that any of this made me truly fearful about the city's future. Still, when it became clear that I wasn't going to get any subsidies to build housing, I decided to try a new tack. I'd always thought that the West 34th Street site would be perfect for a new convention center. The problem was that nearly everyone else had other ideas. For starters, the city, with the support of many prominent local businessmen, had already spent more than 3 years studying and trying to develop another site by the Hudson River at 44th Street. In the planning process alone, the city acknowledged, $13 million had been spent, but people I knew told me that the number was actually closer to $30 million. Then, just weeks after the city said it wouldn't finance any new housing, Beam announced that the city was also freezing further spending on development of the 44th Street location. I immediately hired Samuel H. Lindenbaum, a talented attorney who specialized in zoning and who had been working until then on the 44th Street site. The other person I hired to help with the convention center was a highly dedicated woman named Louise Sunshine, who had extraordinary political connections. Louise had been the finance director for Hugh Carey when he ran for governor in 1974. She was also treasurer of the state Democratic Party. At first, she worked for me for practically no pay. Later, she became an executive in our company. But even as I was assembling a team to promote my site, the city and state were hatching their own alternative, to put the convention center in Battery Park City, opposite the World Trade Center in southern Manhattan. In my opinion, both sites, West 44th Street and Battery Park, were terrible choices. Making my case was another matter. I wanted to wage the battle in public, but I was an unknown. If I was going to attract attention from my site and win support for it, I had to raise my profile. I decided to call my first news conference. Louise and Howard Rubenstein, a major New York public relations executive, helped attract support from several powerful people, including Manfred Orenstein, majority leader of the state Senate, and Theodore Keel, the labor negotiator, who was very powerful in New York politics. Keel delivered a classic line at the press conference. "Placing the new convention center in Battery Park," he said, "is like putting a nightclub in a graveyard. For our part, we put up a huge banner that said, 'Miracle on 34th Street.' And I announced before a ton of reporters that I could build my convention center for $110 million, or at least $150 million less than the city had estimated it would cost to build at West 44th Street. Not surprisingly, that raised some eyebrows and even got us some attention in the press. But there was scarcely an approving peep from the politicians. I discovered, for the first time but not the last, that politicians don't care too much what things cost. It's not their money. In promoting my site, the first thing I pointed out wherever I went was how important it was to build a convention center. A lot of people were saying that the best solution, in light of the city's fiscal crisis, was to scrap the idea altogether. To me, that was classic short-sightedness. For example, in the face of a sales drop, most companies cut back on their advertising budgets. But in fact, you need advertising the most when people aren't buying. Essentially, that's what I said about a convention center. Building one, I argued, was critical to reviving the city's image, and ultimately, to putting its economy back on track. I also told anyone who would listen how great my site was, and how horrible the alternatives were. I pointed out that at 44th Street, The convention center would have to be built on platforms over the water, which would be more costly, more problematic, and ultimately more time-consuming. I said that the 44th Street site was too small, and that there was no room to expand it, and that because it was on the water, you'd have to cross under the crumbling West Side Highway to get to it. Finally, I made a big deal out of the fact that you needed something called a non-navigable permit to build on the 44th Street site. A non-navigable permit, which I became an expert about very quickly, is the federal approval required to build on certain waterways, and getting it requires an act of Congress. I was just as rough on the Battery Park site, which was an even more ridiculous location at the absolute southern tip of the city. I pointed out how remote it was from Midtown, how far from hotels and entertainment, and how inconvenient to public transportation. I also circulated a state study which concluded that building a convention center at Battery Park would require major reconstruction of the West Side Highway leading to it, as well as the addition of at least 2,000 new hotel rooms. Most of all, I talked about what a wonderful location I had on West 34th Street. It was on the right side of the highway, the eastern side, which meant it was easily accessible. It was closer to subways and buses than the alternative sites. I continued to make the case that the center could be built more cheaply on my site, without dispossessing any tenants. Also, because my site was so big, there was plenty of room for expansion in the future. When a group of graduate students in a class taught by City Councilman Robert Wagner did a little study that rated our site the best, I managed to get hold of it and immediately christened it the Wagner Report. Its namesake wasn't thrilled. Before long, I had everything going for me except the support of a few absolutely key people. Abe Beam was at the top of the list. Once he gave up on West 44th Street, Beam got behind Battery Park, and no matter how many great arguments I came up with for my site, he wouldn't budge. Another major opponent was John Zuccotti, a deputy mayor under Beam. He began going around town bad-mouthing my site. The reason, I'm convinced, was that he didn't want to admit that he'd wasted several years of his life and millions of dollars of public money on a location that never made sense in the first place. And that's exactly what I said publicly. I accused him of being self-serving and petty and a half dozen other things. He got pretty riled up. The battle received a lot of media attention, and ultimately, I think, it was good for my site. It became just another way to promote my site's many advantages. In the end, we won by wearing everyone else down. We never gave up, and the opposition slowly began to melt away. In 1977, Beam appointed yet another committee to study the alternative sites, and it concluded that we did have the best site. On that basis, Beam finally gave us his support, although not his signature, just before leaving office at the end of the year. In January of 1978, Ed Koch took over as mayor and decided to do his own study. I figured we were back to square one. But things moved fast, and once again our site came out ahead. Finally, in April 1978, the city and state announced that they had decided to purchase the 34th Street site and build the convention center there. It was a victory for me, but more symbolically than financially. For all the time I'd invested, I earned much less than I deserved, and nowhere near enough to justify the effort financially. As my deal with the Penn Central was structured, I was paid total compensation of about $833,000, based on the $12 million price for the site that the city negotiated with Penn Central. In the end, I offered to forgo my fee altogether, if the city would agree to name the convention center after my family. I've been criticized for trying to make that trade, but I have no apologies. There wouldn't be a new convention center in New York City today if it hadn't been for the Trumps. More important, the city would have saved a fortune by letting me build the center, which I very much wanted to do. Instead, Ed Koch decided, by some logic I could never understand, that because I'd helped arrange the sale of the property, it was a conflict for me to be the builder as well. Eventually, I offered the city a deal that, frankly, was ridiculous for me. I said I would bring the entire job in for less than $200 million, and that if there were any overruns, I'd pay for them myself. You won't find many builders willing to put themselves on the line that way. Instead,